The room looks sort of full. I like this. So I just have a small request. Everybody who's here, just be here all the time. If you had to come from Florida or wherever, that's fine. You can find your way back, and we would appreciate that. Or Cookfield, or from the neighborhood. Good to see everybody here this morning, and the singing was good, and it's encouraging to be together. We're going to be continuing our series in the book of Numbers. If you would turn with me to Numbers chapter 14. Our text will be chapter 16, but I want to tie it in with where we left off last time as a reminder, and maybe for those who weren't here. Last time, in Numbers 14, the people received devastating news. Perhaps the worst possible news for this group of people. They had left Egypt, you remember. They had been led out of slavery to freedom. But really that meant, for the time being, out into the wilderness. And they had been wandering for about a year. They had spent almost that long at Mount Sinai. But then they made their way up to the promised land, and they were just right there on the edge of it. They sent the spies in, but remember, the spies came back and said, hey, these people are strong. We don't have a chance. We're like grasshoppers next to them. And so they rebelled. They said, we can't go in. We're not going. And then as a result of their lack of faith, after all that God had done, he delivers this sentence in verse 28, beginning in Numbers 14, verse 28. God says to Moses, say to them, as I live, declares the Lord, what you have said in my hearing, I will do to you. They said, we're going to die out here in the wilderness. He says, your dead bodies shall fall in this wilderness. And of your number listed in the census from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me, not one shall come into the land where I swore that I would make you dwell, except Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Joshua the son of Nun. Down in verse 35, he says, I, the Lord, have spoken. Surely this I will do to all this wicked generation or congregation who are gathered together against me. In this wilderness they shall come to a full end. There they shall die. Try to imagine the weight of those words on this people. Everybody here who's over 20, if you were there, the news for you would be you're going to live and die out here in this wilderness. What had been just a place to pass through on their way to a land flowing with milk and honey now became their final stop. They were just going to wander around. Instead of being in a lush land that grew all kinds of vegetables and was plentiful, they're going to be out here in a desolation, and that's where you're going to live. You'll get to move around, but this is your home out here in the wilderness. Until you die, and another generation who's going to come after you will be the ones who will get to take the promise. It was so bad, in fact, the news, that basically, like people often do, they were in denial at first. They just refused to accept it. In fact, look what they say in verse 39. When Moses told these words to all the people of Israel, the people mourned greatly. And they rose early in the morning, and they went up to the heights of the hill country, saying, here we are! We will go up to the place the Lord has promised, for we have sinned. They basically say, we get it now. We understand. We were wrong. We want to go. We're ready to go. We believe now. We're going to go. It's too late. And Moses told them, don't go. If you try to go now, the Lord's not going to be with you, and you'll be defeated. But they didn't listen. Verse 44, they presumed to go up to the heights of the hill country, although neither the ark of the covenant of the Lord nor Moses departed out of the camp. Then the Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in the hill country came down and defeated them and pursued them even to Hormah. You know, they say, we get it, we sinned, but they didn't get it at all, because what they had done was they had a lack of faith in God. And now God has said, you're not going to go. And they say, we get it, we know we were wrong, and they went against his word. They still didn't get it. In fact, you'll see by the end of today's lesson, they still don't get it. This generation was not going to get it, and they weren't going to get to go in. And so that's the tragic thing about this particular generation that was led out of the land of Egypt and was supposed to inherit the promise, but they weren't going to be able to. Well, you would think now they understand there is no choice. The land of promise is off limits. I mean, they tried to go even though Moses told them not to, and they got whipped and they ran out. And so now they're stuck out there in the wilderness to the south of Israel, and that's their only choice, really, is just to live until they die. But they weren't done rebelling yet, as we're going to see in today's text, a couple of chapters over. Chapter 15 is some laws about sacrifices and things. We'll skip over most of that. We'll just go straight to chapter 16. So if you would, turn with me there. I'm not going to have really anything until we get to the very end with some applications on the PowerPoint this morning. So just follow along with me in your text, as we'll just stay right here for the most part in chapter 16. Verse 1, now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, and Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men. And they rose up before Moses with a number of the people of Israel, 250 chiefs of the congregation, chosen from the assembly, well-known men. So here is the coup. Here's the rebellion. Here's the mutiny. The organization of this, as we go through the chapter, seems to be Korah is at the top. It is often referred to as Korah's rebellion. And Korah is he is a Levite. He is of the people of Kohath, which were the ones who were given, you remember there was Merari and Kohath and another one. But of the tribes, of the clans of the Levites, they were given particular tasks in taking care of the ark and all of its furniture and helping move it and serving with the priests. The priests were only descendants of Aaron, who was also a Levite, so was Moses. But the priests were particularly Aaron's children. The rest of the Levites had supporting roles. Korah comes from the family of Kohath, and they had the special task of carrying the holy things. So they were given that very honorable job of moving the altar of incense, the Ark of the Covenant, all those things that had poles that slid through them, and they carried them on the shoulders. His group had that responsibility. So it was a very special task, but apparently that was not enough for Korah to be given that honor. As we'll see, he aspired to be the high priest or the priest. That's what he was looking for. So you've got Korah, and then you have Dathan and Abiram and On, who are Reubenites. And they join in this seemingly for sort of different reasons. It becomes obvious as we read through the chapter that they aren't completely together with Korah in his ambition, but they all agree on the fact that they want a change of direction, a change of leadership. And then under, so you have Korah, those three men, and then there's 250 leaders of the people, well-respected, well-known men that represent the rest of the Israelites pretty much, or at least, you know, a good chunk of them. So that's a large group of people who basically assemble before Aaron and Moses and say, hey, you know, we want to change. Now notice what they say. Verse 3, they assembled themselves together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, you have gone too far, for all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord? Now their argument is totally bogus, but it is interesting. Their argument is, we're all God's chosen people. We're all holy. We're all, you know, equal. So why are you setting yourselves up as the ones who are telling us what to do? And particularly, probably, this complaint comes because Moses has now delivered this devastating news to them. We're all going to go out here and we're going to wander around in this wilderness till we die. And they don't like that direction at all. And so they're asking Moses, why are you and Aaron the ones who get to say what we're going to do and where we're going to go? We're all God's people here. We're all kind of equal. And you would think that perhaps they're thinking, we just don't even need a leader. But really, that's not their case. Korah wants to be the new leader. They want a change of leadership is what they want. Verse 4, when Moses heard it, he fell on his face, and he said to Korah and all his company, in the morning, the Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and will bring him near to him. The one whom he chooses, he will bring near to him. So Moses decides, we're going to let God sort this out. Moses isn't going to fight them off or tell them, no, you can't be the priest or you can't be the leader. He basically says, we're going to just let God say tomorrow who is holy and who is going to be the leader. How is God going to do that? Verse 6, he says, take censers, Korah and all his company, put fire in them and put incense on them before the Lord tomorrow, and the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the holy one. You've gone too far, sons of Levi. So he said, you know, a censer is something that they would burn incense on. He said, every one of you bring your own censer, come to the tent of meeting, and basically perform the task of a priest. You come and just start being priests, and we'll see We'll let God choose who he's pleased with and who he's not pleased with. And if he accepts you, sort of good for you. I mean, that's sort of what Moses is saying. So everybody show up tomorrow, bring your censer and get ready to be a priest, and we'll let God sort out, who he wants to be doing this. And it's interesting, he shifts at the end of that. He says, you've gone too far, sons of Levi. And then he particularly addresses Korah, beginning in verse 8. Moses said to Korah, hear now, you sons of Levi, is it too small a thing for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do service in the tabernacle of the Lord, and to stand before the congregation to minister to them? And that he has brought you near him and all your brothers, the sons of Levi, with you? And would you seek the priesthood also? Therefore, it is against the Lord that you and your congregation have gathered together. What is Aaron that you grumble against him? As we've said already, the Levites have been chosen for a special task, the Kohathites a special task within the Levites, and yet that wasn't enough. But as Levites, they should have been the last ones to rebel against God. They had been close, God had pulled them near to him, so to speak. And so they should have been the ones out there teaching other people, we've got to follow Moses, we've got to follow Aaron. And imagine the power of somebody in the position of Korah, who is a Levite, that now he's joined up with the rebellion. In fact, he's the one they probably put in charge of this because he's a Levite. But what if, on the other hand, he had been saying to those people, to people like Dathan and Abiram, when they said, we need a change of leadership. What if he had said, no, the Lord has chosen them. The Lord has anointed Aaron to be the priest. We're not supposed to do that. He maybe could have tamped down on the whole thing if the priests and the Levites had been doing what they should have been doing. But instead, when someone of his stature says, yes, we need a change, why are they leaders? Now it becomes it adds a lot of legitimacy to this rebellion to have someone like Korah leading. And that's why I think Moses singles him out for a special rebuke. It's bad enough that these Reubenites are here, but you, a Levite, someone who God gave this special task to, you know better, and you shouldn't have done this. And so that's why he addresses these words to him. It's interesting that the plan was the next day they were supposed to assemble, but Dathan and Abiram aren't having any part of it. Look at verse 12. Moses sent to call Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and they said, we're not coming up. Korah apparently was okay with this showdown. Korah's motivation was to become the priest. So he liked the idea of, I'm going to show up with my censer tomorrow morning. We're going to see who's going to be priest. Dathan and Abiram say, nah, we're not doing that. In fact, it seems like they're done taking any instructions from Moses at this point. So, Moses, you can tell us whatever you want to say, but we're not doing anything you tell us. So we're not coming up. We're not coming to this, meeting tomorrow. We won't be there. What, by the way, you notice somebody's name hasn't been mentioned again. In verse 1, there were four men. Korah, Dathan, Abiram, and On. And On is never mentioned again in the rest of the chapter. Some speculate that maybe he kind of came to his senses when he saw how this was going. I don't know. I hope for his sake that that's true. From here on out, we'll hear about Dathan and Abiram and Korah and what happens to them. On's not mentioned anymore. So maybe On kind of had a little bit of a wake-up call at some point and decided he'd back off and not follow through with this rebellion. Well, if Dathan and Abiram weren't trying to take over the priesthood, what was their motivation? We find out in verse 13 through 15. They say, is it a small thing that you've brought us up out of the land flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness, that you must also make yourself a prince over us? Moreover, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor given us inheritance of fields and vineyards. Will you put out the eyes of these men? We're not coming up. We will not come up. So notice the subtle accusation. Not too subtle. I mean, what they're saying is Moses had tricked them. In fact, that last expression, will you put out the eyes of these men? According to two different commentary type things I looked at, one, they both say that this had the meaning of, it was like an idiom that meant to sort of pull the wool over someone's eyes or to hoodwink them. So like, you're not going to fool us. You promised us that a land flowing with milk and honey. And in fact, did you notice they said you brought us out of a land flowing with milk and honey? They take that description of the promised land and now they've turned it upside down and said, that's what you drug us out of. We were practically in paradise. Of course, what is the truth of the matter? It was horrible. They were slaves and beaten and it was terrible. But they now they're saying, you took us out of a land flowing milk and honey, and you promised us a better place with vineyards, and you haven't delivered at all. In fact, here we are, and now you're telling us we're going to just walk around out here in this wilderness till we die? This is, you're not going to fool us anymore. What are they completely leaving out in all of this? God, right? They're completely leaving out God. But they're also completely leaving out any kind of responsibility on their part for why they're going to be wandering for the next 40 years. They're making it sound as if Moses had tricked them, or Moses wasn't honest, or Moses hasn't kept his word, when in reality, of course, they would already be entering the promised land at this point if they had had faith in God. But they conveniently overlooked their part in why they're where they are, as people very, very, very often do. And we'll talk about that a little bit in the application part in just a few minutes. Now, the next day is the day of reckoning. The leaders of the rebellion are in two different places. Korah and the 250 men show up for the showdown at the tent of meeting. Dathan and Abiram stay home. They're at their tents with their family, and they say, we're not going. So, verse 19 says, Korah assembled all the congregation against them at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all the congregation. So, as God often does, at first he threatens to kill the entire group of them. The Lord, verse 20, spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment. They fell on their faces, as they often did, and said, O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin, and will you be angry with all the congregation? And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, say to the congregation, get away from the dwelling of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. So first he said, you and Aaron, get out of here, I'm going to kill them. And they say, no, please just kill the ones who are guilty. And so God says, then tell everybody to back away from their dwelling place. And so they do that. Verse 27, Moses relayed the message to the people. In verse 27, they got away from the dwelling of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out, and they stood at the door of their tents together with their wives, their sons, and their little ones. And Moses said, hereby shall you know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, and that it has not been of my own accord. If these men die as all men die, or if they are visited by the fate of all mankind, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord creates something new, and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them, and they go down alive into Sheol, then you shall know that these men have despised the Lord. And as soon as he had finished speaking all these words, the ground under them split apart, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with all their households and all the people who belonged to Korah and all their goods. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive into Sheol, which is, of course, the word for basically the grave or the place of the dead. And the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. And all Israel who were around them fled at their cry, for they said, lest the earth swallow us up. And, verse 35, fire came out from the Lord and consumed the 250 men offering the incense. The punishment from God is going to take three forms. We're going to see two of them right here. First one is, the ground just swallowed these people up and all their stuff and all their families, and it closed back over them. And it said the congregation ran and fled away at their cry, which makes it sound like they heard them screaming as the ground's closing back up. And that's what makes everybody run. It's a terrifying, it's one of the more, to me, of all the different things that God does to people in punishments, this is one that really kind of captures the imagination as being just particularly terrifying. But this was to show, right, how God felt about what they were saying and doing. They refused to come. They refused to do anything. They said, we're not going. We're not following you. We're not obeying. We're not doing it. We're going to stand right here with our families, and we're not doing what you say. And the ground opened up, and that was that. They were gone. Then that's basically phase one of the consequence of this rebellion. Part two is the 250 men, and it seems like Korah was probably still with them as well, although it's not really clear whether he was swallowed up or whether he was there at the tent of meeting. But the others who were offering incense, who had come with their censers, were all burned up with fire, like Nadab and Abihu had been, if I remember correctly. Fire of the Lord came out and consumed them. So they're all dead. And now, you would think everybody understands the point of this, right? But I'm just going to tell you now, you can forget this particular generation of Israelites ever putting two and two together and figuring out what's going on. Because notice what happens the next thing, verse 41. On the next day, all the congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron and said, "You have killed the people of the Lord." They don't get it. They're not going to get it. That's why another generation is going to be the one to go into the land. Now the third punishment from God begins, a plague among the people. He had threatened to wipe them all out, and now he's carrying out his word. Verse 46, Moses said to Aaron, "Take your censer, put fire in it from off the altar, and lay incense on it, and carry it quickly to the congregation and make atonement for them, for the wrath has gone out from the Lord. The plague has begun." So Aaron took it, as Moses had said, and ran into the midst of the assembly. And behold, the plague had already begun among the people. And he put on the incense and made atonement for the people. And he stood between the dead and the living. And the plague was stopped. Now those who died in the plague were 14,700, besides those who died in the affair of Korah. And Aaron returned to Moses at the entrance of the tent of meeting when the plague was stopped. So, as we see, it was necessary for this generation to die in the wilderness, and hopefully their children would have more faith in God and would be able to connect the dots and have the right kind of heart and repent of their sin, because these people are very rebellious. And it was only because of Moses and Aaron's repeated intercession on their part. They weren't just wiped out several times along the way. But they're going to live long enough to die out of old age in the wilderness. And their kids, as we will hopefully see at some point in the future, will be able to choose whether or not to follow Joshua. Remember what he said to them, "Take a stand. I'm putting my stake down now. It's for me and my house. We're going to follow the Lord, and you choose what you're going to do." That would be said to their children. But this generation was never chose to put their faith in God. And so it's a sad story for sure in Numbers chapter 16, with many frightening sort of lessons for us to consider. Let's look at three of them now, and the lesson will be yours. Obviously, as we just back up and think about it, the primary lesson this whole thing is, you can't rebel against God. God being who he is, it isn't going to work. You can't, get a big enough group of people to say, "We're changing direction. We're going to do something different." It doesn't work that way. No matter who you are, you can't rebel against God. God doesn't tolerate that. We see that most vividly in the ground opening up and swallowing their tents. But if we think about it a little bit deeper, who were Moses and Aaron? Remember what Moses said, "Who is Aaron? Why are you rebelling against him?" Who were Moses and Aaron? Well, Aaron was the high priest who had been chosen by God, and at times the spokesman. Moses was the one who was the mediator and who through whom God gave the law, right? So they were God's spokesman to the people. So when Moses gave them directions, or when he said, "This is what we're going to do," or "This is what God says, or you can't do that, or you must do this," it wasn't, as Moses said, "My own thoughts." This was what God was revealing through him. In fact, turn back to chapter 12. There was sort of a minor revolt in chapter 12 that came from Moses' own family, Aaron and Miriam, his brother and sister, when they didn't like his new wife or his wife that he had married. We covered this lesson in the Bible lab Wednesday night, and I titled it for the kids, "I bet you don't know the story of when Moses married a black woman and his sister turned white." They said, "I don't know that story." I said, "Yeah, let's read that story. It's in Numbers chapter 12. And then I clarified, we don't know for sure this particular Ethiopian woman was black, but most of them are. So anyway, I don't really know, for sure about the color of her skin, but his sister does turn white. We'll have to save that for another story, though. You can read that story on your own. It's an interesting one. But in this case, they don't like Moses' new wife, and they say to him, "Hey, doesn't God speak through us too?" And they kind of complained. And God comes down, and he straightens them out. Notice what he says to them in verse 5. "The Lord came down in a pillar of cloud and stood at the entrance of the tent and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both came forward. And he said, 'Hear my words. If there's a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. With him I speak mouth to mouth, clearly, not in riddles, and he beholds the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses?' And the anger of the Lord was kindled against them, and he departed." So when Moses spoke to the people, it wasn't some vague idea about what perhaps God might want. It was, he was relaying God's words to them that he got from the mouth of God. So when Moses says, you must do this and you cannot do that and we're going to go here, he was telling them exactly what God wanted them to know. Now, what is the claim that they made when they come to him? Hey, we're all God's people. We're all holy. We have just as much right to decide what to do as you do. What were they leaving out? The fact that Moses was given God's revelation directly, and he's a spokesman for God. Now, let's make the application to ourselves. How does that apply to us? Well, first of all, we think about the role of the lawgiver, the mediator of the covenant, and the high priest. Who is all that fulfilled in? That all points to Jesus. Jesus fills both the role that Moses was playing and Aaron was playing. Jesus is our high priest. He is the lawgiver. He's the mediator of our new covenant. So he fulfills all that. But who do we hear from through Jesus? The spokesman. His prophets and apostles, that his spirit, remember he said, I'll send my spirit and he'll give you the words, the things that my father gives me, I'll give to him and he'll give to you. And so when we read what's written in the New Testament, we are hearing the words that come from God, just like when Moses spoke to them. Turn me to 1 Corinthians chapter 2. And notice what Paul says about this. 1 Corinthians chapter 2. This is an important point for our day and age. Verse 11, beginning. For who knows a person's thoughts except the spirit of that person which is in him? So also no one comprehends the thoughts of God except the spirit of God. Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit who is from God, that we might understand the things freely given us by God. And we impart these in words not taught by human wisdom, but taught by the spirit, interpreting spiritual truths to those who are spiritual. Very often today, the same thing happens that happened in Korah's rebellion. And here's how it goes. A big enough group of people get together and they say, hey, we're all Christians. We're all God's people. We're going to change the direction that this boat is headed. We're going to just modify some of the rules. We're going to overlook a few things that aren't popular anymore. We're going to go in this direction. We don't really agree with what, you know, some of the things that are written here. Paul, you know, Paul, he was had some problem with women, I guess. And these things about restrictions on marriage, you know, one woman, one man for life, and you know, all that stuff is way too restrictive, and it's old-fashioned, and we've got better ideas, and aren't we, after all, God's people, and doesn't His Spirit dwell among us? So aren't we empowered to make these changes or say this new direction? And the same attitude that you see here in Korah and his company, that same attitude is still prevalent. And people will say things like, wouldn't God want, or I just believe that God would want, have you heard somebody say that? I just really believe that God would want this. He would want me to do this. And you know what Paul says here? You don't know a thing about what God thinks. Only a person's spirit knows what's in their heart. And we have received the words that were revealed by God's Spirit, and that's what I'm writing to you. So unless God's Spirit has revealed something directly to you, which by the way, here it is, and there is his spokesman, just like Moses was his spokesman, and God said, don't you understand? When I talk to Moses, I'm talking to him, and he tells you what I say. So don't speak against him. And that's not the same thing as being part of the congregation. And so we are part of the congregation, but we aren't the prophets and the spokesmen. And we have no right to say, well, I just feel like God would want this or that. You only can know what God would want if he reveals it to you through his Spirit. Otherwise, we can kind of guess, and we might have some ideas, and there are things even I have ideas about that I think, well, I feel like, you know, I think I know how God, but you know what? That doesn't count for anything. Because really what that is what I think. It's not, I can't say what God thinks. All I can say is what I think about it, and what I think doesn't count for anything. And so, we have to be very careful that we don't have this same attitude, because I think it's very prevalent in our day and time that people say, we are the people too, and we're gonna take a different direction on this. So that's the first lesson from that. And I would suggest to you, if you want to know how God feels about that kind of thing, just remember that ground opening up and swallowing their tents, and that will remind us. Secondly, We see a total lack of any kind of accountability and personal responsibility on the people here. They're angry that they're out there in the wilderness. They're furious with Moses and Aaron. And they forget all about the fact the only reason why they have to wander around 40 years is because of their choices and their rebellion. They just ignore that completely and they take out their anger, and that is so typical, isn't it? How many people in life, in general, get themselves into the biggest mess and the only response they have is to be angry and bitter at everybody else, and they can never look in the mirror somehow and recognize their own complicity in their circumstances. That the fact that maybe I'm suffering because I keep making the wrong choices. Or maybe I'm in this boat, I'm in this, you know, mess because of, instead what they do is so typical. They find anybody that's in any kind of authority. They blame the boss. They blame the teacher for their grades. They blame the parents for their upbringing that led them to be where they are. They blame everybody in society. They blame the judge. They blame the cops. They blame anybody in the world who's got any kind of authority because my life isn't great and things aren't going good for me. So it must be everybody else's fault. Because that's easy, right? That's the wimpy, you know, sorry way out. The hard thing is to look in the mirror and say, have I done anything, you know, is there something I need to straighten out? Is there something I need? Am I responsible for this circumstance that I am in? And we're not always. Was Job responsible for, that's what his friend said. Remember Job's friend said, this must be your fault. Nothing like this happens to anybody unless they bring it on themselves. So don't misunderstand. I'm not saying every bad thing happens because it's a consequence of our behavior. That's a mistake. But sometimes we are suffering because we've made bad choices, or we are not doing the right things, and we're just feeling the consequence of that, which I believe the Bible describes as a chastising and a discipline of the Lord. Look with me at Hebrews chapter 12. In Hebrews chapter 12, he's talking there about their suffering in general, but he makes some points about suffering that I think apply in this sense. We could read quite a few of these verses, but we're just going to read two for the sake of time this morning, verses 5 and 6, where he quotes, "Have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not lightly regard the discipline of the Lord, nor be wearied when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves and chastises every son whom he receives." It seems to me like we have a couple of choices. So we can learn the easy way. This is the whole point of Proverbs. Son of mine, listen to what I'm saying. I'm going to try to save you a whole lot of pain in life. Don't follow those people and do what they're doing. Choose this path, and you're going to save yourself a lot of trouble. But what happens a lot of times? We don't learn the easy way. The easy way is listen and do what the wisdom from above tells us, and your life is going to be a lot better. But a lot of times we are stubborn. And so we say, you know, I know that's what I was told, and I know that's what that says, but I'm going to do this because I really feel like it. And then we get a chance to learn the hard way, right? This is, I believe, that idea of discipline. I begin to suffer because of my own choices. And now, hopefully, the point of all that is that I realize, wow, this really stinks. You know, this hurts. I don't like this at all. Well, what, ding, 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 what should I be learning from all that? Maybe I need to change my attitude, change my, you know, ways, repent of some rebellion. And then if I do, then that chastisement has served its purpose, just like a parent who's punishing their child, and you're hoping the whole time that at some point this connects in their mind and they realize, hey, I'm tired of getting in trouble. I'm going to quit acting like that, or I'm going to do this thing that, you know, I'm going to do something better. And, you know, I can say that as a parent, but I've also been there as a kid, you know, so that's the, we've all lived through that on the receiving end, and a bunch of us on the giving end as well. And the Hebrews author uses the illustration of a father and his son to say, you are suffering, and some of that may be this discipline of the Lord. The children of Israel, from the time they left Egypt, had been rebelling against God, and he had been training them, and he had been disciplining them and teaching them and instructing them, and they were never getting it. So that now, even at this late hour of Numbers chapter 16, after they basically the door to the promised land has been slammed shut, they're still saying, Moses, it's your fault. You didn't do this. And they never looked inward. And that's why they had to die in the wilderness. And the point for us is we have this opportunity, and God is patient with us, but he wants us to repent. And so if in general, we're going through something, we're suffering. If things aren't working out, if like there's relationship problems or I'm having trouble and you know, I just don't understand and it feels like everything's against me, that may be a reason to stop and really do some looking in the mirror and do the hard thing and ask myself, is there something I'm contributing to this? Am I not being loving? Am I not being forgiving? Am I not following the instructions that God has given me? And if the answer is yes, then you need to repent. This is your way of learning the hard way. And that's okay. It's better to learn the hard way than not to learn at all. The best thing is to learn the easy way. But learning the hard way is okay too, as long as you get the point. What you don't want to do is be like these people who suffered along all the while and never put it together and never got it. So don't take that approach, because it just leads to dying in the wilderness. And then finally, one last quick point that's kind of one that may be worth its own lesson at some point. But it's interesting just to consider here. Turn to Numbers chapter 6 so you'll be ready for it when we get there. Was anybody else a little bit troubled that Dathan and Abiram's family and kids were swallowed up too? Did y'all notice that? They stood at the door of their tents with their families, and it says, and their little ones. That's hard, isn't it, to picture that, little kids being swallowed up. And for some people, this is one of their biggest beefs with the whole Bible. I know somebody who told me basically the reason why he was not going to be a Christian or believe in the Bible is because in the Old Testament, God instructed them to go and wipe out the Canaanites, and they destroyed men, women, and children indiscriminately. And you know, that the challenge of the destruction of innocence is a hard kind of a topic, you know, to wrestle with. Why was that okay? And here we see a good illustration of that that maybe will help us understand it. Dathan and Abiram took their stand together with their families in defiance of the God, and they stood together and they died together. Now, their little kids were not responsible for that, but they were all together as a family, and they suffered the consequences of the rebellion of their parents. And in fact, very often in life, children suffer the consequences of the rebellion of their parents. That is a very, very common thing that happens all the time, including dying, and things even worse than that. When parents are evil, oftentimes the kids suffer as a result of that in this life. But we know from the rest of scriptures that on judgment day, we'll each give account of ourselves. So I have total confidence that if those little kids had nothing to do with this rebellion, God's not going to hold that against them in the final analysis. They may have suffered in this life by being swallowed up and their life being over, but on the judgment day, I don't expect at all that they would be held accountable for the choice of their mom and dad to rebel. They were too young to really have a say in it, but they were all together and they all suffered together. That's a difficult thing, but it's a fact that we run into in the scriptures, and we can't really, you know, dodge it. That's just a fact of life. But what's interesting is, notice in Numbers chapter 6, let's read verses 9 through 11. The sons of Eliab, Nemuel, Dathan, and Abiram. These are the Dathan and Abiram chosen from the congregation who contended against Moses and Aaron in the company of Korah when they contended against the Lord. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up together with Korah when that company died, when the fire devoured 250 men, and they became a warning. Verse 11, but the sons of Korah did not die. Why did the sons of Korah not die? Apparently, they were old enough to make their own mind up, and they did not join in that company of people who stood there before the tent of meeting with their censors. They did not join in the rebellion, and they were not killed on that day. And in fact, later on, the sons of Korah redeemed his name to a certain degree, because we find in the Psalms a bunch of Psalms attributed to the sons of Korah. And we find during the administration of King David that the sons of Korah were put over the charge of some of the music of the worship of God. And so the sons of Korah as a lineage were yet to serve God honorably and glorify God in worship. And the point that I want to make is that as adults, as people who are old enough to choose for ourselves, we don't have to follow in the path of our parents. It may be that someone's parents have rebelled against God like Korah's dad, of course, Korah did. But his sons did not die because of his rebellion. They went on to live, and they went on to serve God, at least their future generations. And so our family, you know, you could have a patriarch or a matriarch or somebody in the family turn away from God and rebel against God, but we can still choose individually to serve God and have generations of people who would serve God faithfully, in spite of the fact that someone in the family perhaps turns away from God. So each of us has to give an answer for ourselves. We each have to choose what we're going to do. And in the judgment day, we'll all stand before God and we'll all answer for the choices that we have made. And that brings us to, of course, the invitation. Perhaps there's someone here today who has been rebelling against God. Maybe you've been suffering a lot because of your own choices and you're ready to quit being stubborn like the people of Israel were and say, okay, I give. I know I need to change and I'm ready to do that now because I'm tired of doing it my way. It hurts. That would be a good thing because that's God's discipline having its desired effect. Maybe there's someone who's never become a child of God. If we could help you in being baptized and have your sins washed away or any other thing, if we can help you, let us know as we stand and sing.